This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry, along with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Sam, we're back in our normal time slot, recording just after the close on Friday, June 4th, what in normal times would have been a piece of Friday at DoubleLine. But let's get into the market short week. Kind of a quiet week, but I guess I won't front run you, your market side of things.
Yeah, appreciate that, Jeff. And I do appreciate the reminder on Pizza Friday. Do you remember that time when Jenny ruined Pizza Friday and ordered chicken salad instead? And that just got squashed within, it didn't last more than that one round, but that was... Well,
she had to run downstairs and buy a certain someone his own pizza.
Pepperoni, probably, right?
Yeah, yes.
So, all right, good times, good memories. So let's get after the market update. So it looks like another positive week for performance with the S&P 500 up about 60 basis points for the week to date. That was led by the energy sector up a whopping 6.75 percentage points for just 1 week. So definitely some strong performance there. Moving across to fixed income land, I see that the 10-year treasury yield closed the week at 1.56%. So just a few basis points lower on the week, but that's likely on the back of the some of the data that we saw come out today specifically. So I will return the favor and not front run you too much there as well. But keep in mind that it seemed like a lot of the vacillation in the 10-year treasury yield did come around today, just on the back of that news. So in turn, with the lower yields on the 10-year treasury, we saw that the U.S. bond aggregate was up about a quarter point with all sectors in the green. Moving over to the commodity front, we see that WTI crude oil is encroaching on that $70 handle. So it's up about 5% over on the week, and that's on positive news as well for the crude oil front there.
Yeah, don't forget that when we recorded earlier before the close last week, we were flirting with, it was like a $66.95 per barrel on WTI. We asked you, whether you thought it would be above or below 67. You said below. It did, going into the close, actually closed at 66.32. And then Thursday, it was flat, but was up the rest of the week. So You were right there for the close on last Friday, but we're flirting with, as you said, flirting with 70 now.
Yeah, that's that for our listeners. That was we recorded that episode a little bit early just to give our folks that helped produce it some more time instead of working into the late hours on a holiday Friday. So a little victory lap there, but I guess it's not as hard to forecast like a 3-hour move in the market before the close, because if I recall correctly, that's we recorded it about 3 hours early that
yeah, but
day.
A 3-hour move in oil, it's not like a 3-hour move in the 10-year.
That's right. And as I'm experiencing now, a 3-hour move in cryptos is not the same as a 3-hour move in crude either. So
right,
just
right.
Increasing points of volatility across these asset classes that we talk about. But winding our way through commodities, we've got gold down about 60 basis points on the week, which took spot prices negative again on the year-to-date basis at just down about 20 basis points for the year there. So gold has just been struggling a bit as opposed to the stellar performance in 2020. And then the final note I'd make is that the broad commodity index, again, looks to be leading the other asset classes, and it's up a flat 2% this week to date, as of this Friday. And on the year to date, it's up over 20%. So definitely a strong year for commodities thus far.
That's right.
So with that, do you want to kick us off on what happened last week on the macro front?
Yep, sounds good. It's a short week, but there was a lot of data points out. As we kind of highlighted last week in our things to keep an eye on, we had ISM manufacturing on Tuesday, came in just as expected. It's now 12 consecutive months greater than 50, so in an expansionary mode for manufacturing. Then also on Tuesday, the as we kind of hinted at earlier, the OPEC Plus meeting, there's no real changes there. They're keeping their monthly meetings going on. It seemed like there was some fear that they were Iran's oil supply was going to hit the market, and that's kind of why we did see oil rally on Tuesday on the backs of that meeting. Thursday we had ISM services came in high, a little bit higher than expected at 64, which was the highest on record. It was expected to be 63.2, so slight beat there, and similar to the manufacturing number, this one is all 18 service industries reported growth. So that's a good sign that the economy is also on the recovery side of things. And then kind of later on Thursday, the Fed, it's not really a macro thing, but the Fed did announce that their portfolio of corporate credit bonds and ETFs that they bought in the, I guess it was about a year ago now, when they really started buying the corporate credit side of things, even though it was announced earlier in March, that they're going to start to unwind the portfolio beginning on June 7th, so when people will be listening to this episode, and kind of wind it down through the remainder of the year. It's not really a lot of size, only about $14 billion in terms of assets, but it's more sending a message to the market that, you know, it was an extraordinary measure for them to buy the corporate credit, and it's not like the quantitative easing where they say that they're going to. Or that when they buy it and they just hold it onto their balance sheet, they're going to be actively selling these corporate credit holdings. Yeah. And you know, kind of interestingly, the Fed had to come out and say that even though they are unwinding the corporate credit facilities, that does not mean that they're going to start tapering the quantitative easing. They kind of had to kind of calm the fears of people that they were, you know, backdoor announcing a taper on a random Thursday.
Yeah, I'm sure they had the market on the edge of their seats, just trying to get to the conclusion there. But it was interesting to note that the exit of this extraordinary program was somewhat quiet. It was very quiet, right? I mean, we're talking about how the market, the IG market, barely moved on the news, and that's just in stark contrast with the announcement back, as you said, a year plus, and a year ago on the execution, where it just really boosted and supported a fragile and, you know, a declining market at that point.
Yeah, it shows. And as you know, they just had to announce it. By the time they actually started buying the bonds and the ETFs, the market had almost fully recovered. So that just shows why they only bought $14 billion out of the, I don't remember what the total size, yeah, but much larger than that.
And was that when Powell basically just came out and said, we don't really need to do it, but I wanted to show that, you know, our word is good. So he just bought a little bit. Was that the
right
occasion?
Right. They said we're doing it because we said we would do it. Right. So, I guess that makes sense. You got to make sure that you're believable.
Where they lost credibility everywhere else, at least they can maintain it here through that program. Great.
Yeah, they have no problem buying assets. And then today, as you hinted at earlier, today was the big market moving event, the non-farm payroll number, payroll Friday. The number came out at 559,000, so disappointing. Both the actual median consensus of 675,000, and also was hearing that the so-called whisper number, so people were didn't want to put out their actual forecast, but they were expecting a number as high as 800,000. So that would have been even over our optimistic, or I guess my optimistic guess from last week. So a pretty disappointing number. You, I guess that 1 million jobs number that we did get a couple months ago, I think it's kind of anchored people's expectations for the numbers to be higher. Because if you said we're still cranking out 559,000 jobs on a monthly basis, that's still a pretty good number in terms of overall jobs. We are still making good progress towards an overall full recovery, just at a slower pace than people were expecting on the back of that million jobs number.
Yeah.
A couple months ago.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that is still a very strong new jobs added number there. And the expectations have seemed to just get a little bit out of line. And as you and I have talked about a couple times or mentioned a few times here now, is that, we think some of the easier jobs to fill have been filled already. And, we are approaching that point too as well, where some of these the emergency federal unemployment benefits are going to be start. I think they're due overall to expire in September, but a number of states, nearly half of the states now, have announced an early sunset for the programs, ranging anywhere between, I saw the earliest maybe around June 12th, and then going through the middle of next month as well. So it'll be interesting to see if we do see some payrolls arise as those benefits set sunset. So it'll be perhaps a way to end some of the, or settle some of this debate that's been going around about the incentives of the unemployment benefits.
That's right. And so, I think that this number and the prospect of the number maybe increasing over the next few months doesn't, from a Fed perspective, doesn't really take the taper discussion off the table. I've heard that people still say, oh, it's going to be, they still look kind of looking at the Jackson Hole conference in August as when they're going to discuss the tapering or start talking about the taper, I guess, instead of just talking about the taper.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then also today, the unemployment numbers came out at 5.8 versus the 5.9% expected, so just a little bit of tick down, which is good. And then we still have a long way to go on the underemployment number. So 10.2%. It was a 10.4 last month. So a little bit of a tick down there, but still shows we have a long way to go for that number to get to a more normal number. And that certainly it continues to be what the Fed is looking at in terms of when the market has fully recovered or the economy has fully recovered.
Yeah, and just to dive into it a little bit more too, and just take some of the tools that we provided in one of our previous Monday Morning Minute podcasts, where we dissected the ways to look at both the non-farm payroll and the unemployment numbers. If we utilize some of that information, then we look at the labor force, for instance. The labor force did shrink this reporting period by about just over 50,000, which in the past, we said that might be a negative thing when we see it coincide with an improvement in the U3 unemployment rate. But I think this period, what struck me is that we saw around 450,000 people transition from the unemployed category into the employed. So while the labor force did shrink by 50K or so, seeing that improvement from unemployed to employed by about 450,000 was a strong positive, I think, that was beneath that headline number.
Yeah, that's right. It's always good to kind of, especially with those percentage numbers, as we did talk about in that podcast a while back, that got to dig into those numbers, because the high level, top level numbers don't really give you the full picture.
Yeah. And then one other thing, just since I'm so positive in nature today, it seems like, but I also saw improvement in one of these numbers that we've been tracking recently as well. And that's the number of long-term unemployed, those that have been unemployed for 27 plus weeks, again, on the back of some of these emergency programs that were instituted through the course of the second and third quarters of last year. But that cohort had been steadily increasing since March of last year. So we did see that reverse a little bit, and it's good to see what I think might be a reversal of the direction. So again, maybe this will continue to fall going into the remainder of the year. And if so, that definitely is a positive sign.
Yeah, maybe you don't buy into the what we have here in Southern California, the June gloom. You get the happiness in June.
Trying to bring some positivity to everyone around me.
That's right. So we can always count on you for that, Sam.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so let's move on to the question of the week this week. And we received a similar question from two different listeners this past week. So we felt like we had to answer it. So those of you that have a question and you want it answered quickly, you know, you could get your friends to also email us the same question, and maybe that'll incentivize us to answer it faster, I guess. So we want to thanks to Thomas and Jordan for the question about the Fed's reverse repo program, and specifically the increased usage of it over the past few weeks and months. And you know, try to kind of sum up their questions. They want to know, does it mean anything really? Is it who cares? And obviously, from my perspective, if it was a who cares, they wouldn't be asking about it. Does it force T-bills to go more negative? Does it force the Fed to taper sooner? And so to kind of get a more expert opinion on this, we hit up our U.S. government team again to get their take on things. And so we want to give a shout out to Elaine, Hannah, and Gregory for their insight in this. So Sam, why don't you kick us off with, you know, what's going on and why it matters?
All right, sounds good, Jeff. So you know, as always, let's begin with the definition here. So the official or the full name of it would be the overnight reverse repo agreement, and that's it's a facility that was launched by the Fed, specifically the FOMC, or also known as the Federal Open Market Committee. But this was a facility that they put in place back in 2014 as a way to help control the Fed funds rate. So it's really another tool that was born out of the quantitative easing experiment that began post-GFC, as was that corporate credit facility that you just mentioned that just sunsetted as well. So we've definitely had a whole host of new tools that the Fed has so creatively designed to deal with this quantitative easing experiment that they've been embarked on. So what the reverse repo facility entails is it's the sale of treasuries by the Fed to eligible counterparties, with the agreement that the Fed will buy back those securities the following day. And that's why I added the overnight portion to the overnight reverse repurchase agreement. So the rate at which those securities are offered is set by the Fed, and that currently sits at 0% today. The participants here that are within this facility are the Fed, of course, and then also their eligible counterparties. And those counterparties are typically commercial banks and qualified money market funds. As I was doing a little bit of research, I saw that the government's sponsored entities or enterprises, the GSEs, the Fannies and the Freddies of the world, are also eligible participants here. But I would think it's fair to say that the bulk of the transactions are becoming from the commercial banks and the qualified money market funds, especially today, based on the current environment that we're in. So that's the backdrop for the reverse repo facility. I'm going to call it the RRP, using the acronym, because otherwise this is too long and I'll get tongue-tied there. But the RRP itself, it spiked to a record high recently, last Thursday, May 27th, to somewhere around $485 billion on an overnight basis. So when looking back, we saw that while it is indeed a record, it's not the first time that's hit, you know, similar levels, albeit slightly lower. And historically, we've seen that there have been spikes in overnight usage, but those spikes generally coincide with quarter or year-end dates. So there's a bit of window dressing, I guess we can say, of financial statements going on there, perhaps as organizations are trying to shed a little bit of cash in exchange for securities to make their financials look a little bit better. But this recent run-up that we had, again, as I said, it pretty much started in the beginning of May and crescendoed on May 27th at that record high. That doesn't fall on quarter end, so that led perhaps Tom and Jordan to ask the question. So, you know, let's dive into the catalyst of what we think might have been here. And as you mentioned, we got a lot of good information from our Govy team. The short answer is that there's a lot of cash in the system, and that cash needs a home. So a good chunk of that cash has found its way into the money market funds. And those money market funds are accessing the Fed's reverse repo window to get a rate of zero. As I mentioned before, that's what the offering rate is. But that zero might not sound that attractive, but it is much more attractive than getting a negative rate in certain parts of the T-bill market. The longer answer, as you all know, we would be providing, is that this is really a culmination of policy responses that began last March during the pandemic, when we had an emergency shutdown nationwide, and we also had a meltdown of financial markets. So breaking those two up and the accompanying responses, I'll start first with the fiscal response to the nationwide shutdown that came to the tune of just over $6 trillion and it's and counting basically for the various support programs that were provided to corporations, small businesses, and also the consumer, where consumers had direct to pocket stimmy checks that increased, and that overall just increased the amount of money in the system. We saw M2 monetary supply increase during that period of time. At the same time, while this was going on, the Treasury Department's general account, I believe the acronym there is TGA is what has been thrown around, that could be thought of as the Treasury's checking account. That also increased in anticipation, the Treasury's anticipation of further fiscal spending needs perhaps in the future. So get it while they could. But that TGA, the checking account, the Treasury's checking account, spiked to a record high also. I mean, how many times have we been saying the word record here today, Jeff? We're seeing it in economic data. We've seen it in the extraordinary policies that we've embarked on since last Thursday. But the TGA account spiked to a record high of $1.8 trillion by the summer of last year. But it has been running down. I believe Secretary Yellen came in and said that in the beginning of the year that she would be winding down that account balance as well. So true to her word, in the last 4 months alone, the general account has been reduced by somewhere in the neighborhood of $850 billion. And that ultimately also increases the amount of cash that's circulating in the system. In bank reserves. And then you can also see it in the rise of the assets under management within money market funds. Keep in mind that those money market funds, and this will be important later, they are eligible for the RRP. So we've seen it, that reduction in the TGA and also the amount of extra cash that's been going around because of the financial response, the fiscal response, make its way through the system. So on the side of the monetary response, there is also the fiscal policy response. As I mentioned, in addition to this fiscal response, I mentioned before that we also had the financial meltdown. So that's where the Fed stepped in. And through the Fed's monetary policy, the Fed brought back quantitative easing. They did so with a vengeance, and they also introduced a few new tools that you just mentioned earlier, and that brought effectively the Fed's balance sheet to a record high, where it's just under $8 trillion today on the Fed's balance sheet. And this was facilitated on the back of $120 billion per month targeted in asset purchases by the Fed. And that breaks down to be about $80 billion in treasuries and $40 billion in agency mortgage-backed securities being purchased each month. So ultimately, as we've seen time and time again, quantitative easing through the asset purchases increases bank reserves. And those bank reserves have grown by approximately $2 trillion since the start of the pandemic. So one other thing to note, Jeff, you and I, we recorded an episode back in March of this year on something that is known as the supplemental leverage ratio, or SLR. And that SLR is a regulation that banks are subject to. And so I would recommend our listeners to try to tune into that one if they can. Again, I think that was the fourth week in March that we recorded that, because it's important because it does have an impact and can be felt in the RRP usage today. So long story short, there's a high level of reserves coupled with the sunset of the temporary SLR exemption that in part made taking cash deposits less attractive to banks. So winding this down, where does all this cash go? The banks, they don't necessarily want it because it does count against the work against them with the leverage ratios. So in effect, what we've seen is that all of this has made holding customer deposits a little bit less attractive for banks today. So in turn, the banks have tried to nudge depositors to money market funds. And we've seen those assets in those money market funds increase. Not too surprisingly, they've increased similarly to the amount of the increases that we've seen and the unwinds that we've seen of the TGA. So money market funds have increased by about $1 trillion since the start of all these programs. And money market funds are required to make short-dated investments. They can't just sit on cash. So the opportunities for many of these funds, especially those that are specifically government money market funds, their opportunities for investments are limited. So we've seen negative rates on T-bills, which are treasury securities that have a maturity that are inside of 1 year. We've seen negative rates arise there because they've been in high demand. And we've also seen a reduction in available supply as the Treasury Department has reduced the amount of issuance there, as they're actually trying to reduce their own cash balances, as seen through the reduction in the TGA. And they also have very low short-term funding needs at this time. So luckily, many of these money market funds, they are eligible to participate in that Fed reverse repo facility. So they do have the privilege of buying securities with a zero yield, whilst investors like us or investors elsewhere that don't have that privilege of accessing the RRP sometimes find themselves facing negative yielding T-bill securities on their investments. So that's kind of the wrap up of why we're seeing this increased daily usage. As far as the implications go, you know, we have seen these negative yielding T-bills. But one thing that Greg Whiteley did note is, and I found it quite entertaining, is he basically just said that the Fed doesn't seem too concerned. They don't seem concerned at all about the spike in the daily usage of the facility, which is working the way it should. Nor do they seem, you know, particularly concerned with the fact that you're facing negative yields at the short end of the curve. So one of the things that we've seen the Fed do during this period is this March, this past March in 2021, the Fed did increase their daily limit for counterparties accessing the reverse repo facility from about $30 billion to $80 billion. And many people suspect that this rise was in recognition and is in commensurate with the rise in assets that have been managed by the money market funds. So they're really just trying to accommodate them through that increase there. So along with that, the Govy team, they laid out a host of options that the Fed has at their disposal to rectify all these issues or to rectify this negative yielding T-bill issue and the daily usage. But as I said, it seems like the Fed seems content to sit on them for now, at least for now. So some of these options would include raising the interest on reserves paid to banks that could potentially make customer deposits more attractive for the banks and thus alleviate the pressure for money market funds. The Fed could also stop competing for the limited pool of T-bills that are trading in the secondary market. And they're competing through their $80 billion a month treasury purchase program. If they just shifted some of their purchases away from the T-bills, perhaps that could alleviate some of that downward pressure on yields there. And then another option would be to increase the offering rate that they have from zero on the RRP to something a little bit more positive, at least to compete with the secondary market in the treasury and the T-bill market there. And that perhaps could alleviate some pressure there as well. And then finally, you know, of course, this is the topic du jour, the Fed could always taper their purchases. So I expect that option, as well as, you know, perhaps some of these other ones to be hotly contested amongst the members of the Fed, perhaps as soon as, 2 weeks before we have our next meeting?
Yep, 2 weeks on the 16th.
Yeah, so just a couple things to watch, I guess. Hopefully we're not turning everyone into a group of Fed watchers here with our discussion, but it's always nice to get these types of questions from our listeners because, you know, we're able to tie in a lot of the themes and tools and mechanisms that we try to highlight for our listeners. And hopefully it's just, you know, the education process is coming full circle, and it's nice to see that we're able to build on some of this information that we've discussed in the past.
Right. And I just wanted to highlight or clarify something that the reverse repo rate of 0% is not like that's a market rate. It's just the Fed said we'll do this at 0% overnight. So that, you know, they could easily make it you know, 1 or 2 basis points, you know, not 1 or 2 basis points per night, but 1 or 2 basis points annualized over over the entire year, and that would kind of put a little bit of you know, upward pressure, or kind of would raise the floor of T-bill rates to something that's above zero. So I think the idea there is just to, because money market funds, you know, if they have to buy in negative yields, then they lose money, and they potentially could break the buck, as they you know, as happened in the previous crisis. So that's really something they would like to avoid, which is why they set it at zero. But as you said, they don't seem concerned, because it would be easy for them to administratively just say, okay, rate's no longer zero, it's 2 basis points. And you know, and as you said, they could do that, but maybe they're just going to keep it at zero, and you kind of use their taper talk to put a little bit less pressure on the short term market, as the, instead of buying, you know, $80 billion of treasuries a month, when they start tapering that down to, you know, $75 or $70 billion a month, that it's that they feel like that will naturally ease up some of that pressure.
Yeah, and this was actually helpful, this exercise, for me as well, because I do recall not really knowing the reason back then, but I want to say somewhere around the second half of 2020, which is a pretty broad date range, but right in that area is when I remember hearing more about money market funds closing access to new customers. If you're an existing customer, you could continue, you know, piling your money in there if you wanted, but they weren't taking on any new accounts there. So that's just something that kind of brought it full circle for me as well.
Right, because as they, you know, they lose money at these zero rates, right? Because you got to pay your expenses, and if you're not making any money on your investments, and you have expenses, you got to return a, you know, at least a positive number to your investors. Then the kind of manager of it, or the advisor, is probably losing money on that.
Yeah, just strange times around these interventions, I suppose.
Yeah, hopefully kind of it gets figured out, or it works itself out over time, and then maybe the taper is the first step in terms of you know, people earning more than 0% on their cash.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I guess we should just be happy we're not negative, as we've joked about a couple times before. So, you know, hopefully this was helpful to you, Tom and Jordan specifically, but to the rest of our listeners as well. Looks like, you know, looking at the sheet here, Jeff, we got a pretty light week in terms of data points, but in terms of potential impact, it could be pretty significant. I just see a CPI release that we have on Thursday coming out. So I think this might be one of the most anticipated prints, at least for some time now. So,
right. Last month it was a 420 basis points, and surprised people to the upside. This number could be higher. I have seen people expecting as high as 4.6%. But, you know, kind of when we look at the trends and the base effects, this number actually could be the highest CPI print for the rest of the year. So it'll be interesting to see. It certainly could be the market moving event for next week, especially given that there is there's no Fed speak next week, no Fed speeches, because they are in the quiet period before, as we mentioned, their June 16th meeting. So kind of a quiet week, potentially.
Yeah, at least until Thursday.
Right. So let's save up our energy Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and get ready for Thursday.
That sounds good for me.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up again for this week. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in again this week.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for everyone for listening to us. Monday Morning Minutes. You can pick up the latest episode each Monday before the opening bell. We're available in all the familiar places, the iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. So one thing, if you're not finding us where you usually get your podcasts, just let us know. Shoot us an email, or shoot us a Twitter, and we'll see what we can do. You can hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes, or you can send us an email at minutes@doubleline.com if you have any questions, comments, or even hate.
Yeah, you can find more. You can address the hate to Sam. Send it to minutes@doubleline.com, but just say Sam in the message. Yeah. He can read it. You can find more information about Double Line at our website, doubleline.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/doubleline capital. We started posting our videos from our virtual client event that happened in mid-May. So there, the first two are up. First one was a fireside chat with Sam Garza and Jeffrey Gonlock that I thought was very interesting when it happened. And then, of course, Mr. Lau had his event talking about solutions for the current challenging fixed income environment. We did receive a question a while back from as a follow-up to the favorite books podcast that we did on April 9th. And John back then had asked us about how we look at market expectations when we build portfolios. So if you look at Sam's video, that just did get posted to the YouTube channel, and kind of and include our last week's discussion about market expectations, that should help John and our other listeners with that question, which is always a very pertinent. Don't forget to subscribe to Sherman Show Podcast, which we should be back with new episodes in a couple of weeks. You can follow them on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Talk to everyone again next week.
Thanks, everyone. Good luck out there.
Represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.